Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window to the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rota. Our guest today is Francisco Mogoya, head chef of Modernist Cuisine in Seattle and co-author of Modernist Bread, The Art and Science. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Before we get started, a quick word from this week's podcast sponsor. Boxu is a premium Japanese snack and tea subscription box that will take you on a gourmet journey through Japan. Each month, Boxu handpicks the best Japanese snacks and a tea pairing to complement that month's flavors. They source directly from artisanal snack makers in Japan, and their delicious treats can't be found anywhere else. Both of their boxes, the Classic Box and the Tasting Box, ship free worldwide. Sign up today at Boxu, BOKKSU.com. And use the code CLEVER5 at checkout for $5 off your first box. And now, back to our podcast. When people hear modernist cuisine, I think they start to immediately get very afraid. They feel like it's something that happens in restaurants, that's high-tech, that they could never do at home. But in this book, you really try to drive home the idea that that's not the case. So talk a little bit about modernist bread, what it is, and why it's right for home cooks.
Yeah, so our first book, which came out in 2011, was Modernist Cuisine, and that was really geared to it's like a very high-end chef, very scientific, very high-end concepts that for a lot of people, it was a little challenging to wrap their brains around. And when we came out with Modernist Cuisine at Home, a couple years later, it was embraced by a lot more people because it was the same science, just explain for a larger audience. So the clue we got from that was that all the books that we were going to print after that should be for everybody, not just for a very small group of chefs. So when we set out to write the recipes for Modernist Bread, we kept in mind, yes, professional bakers, if you will, but also home bakers and also another group of bakers that is often neglected, which is bakers that work in like restaurants, hotels, country clubs. Recipes aren't really written for those people since it's like they don't fit into one or other category. They don't really fit into artisan bakery. They don't really fit into home baker. So we wanted to have this wide breadth of people that would be able to take advantage of all the information that it took us 4 years to put together. So in a project that is this massive, you know, we're talking about 5 volumes, 2,600 pages, 1,200 recipes. And our goal was to make sure that our recipes were bulletproof, meaning that anybody from any sort of background could replicate our recipes within reason. And I say within reason because, for example, if a home baker, what we would recommend for them is a certain type of recipes, the easier stuff, right? There's varying degrees of difficulty within the world of breads. And so what we have is in various sections of our book, there's recipes that we recommend for, you know, beginners, amateurs, all the way to recipes that are for more advanced bakers that are a little bit more comfortable with, you know, the different techniques and such, and then the very advanced breads. The problem is that if somebody was an amateur and they want to start with a very advanced bread, we're not going to stop them from doing that, but there's a good chance that they may not be successful, even with all the information, because There's certain things that you have to do when you make bread, which is, you know, the most important one, hands down, is practice. And these are the things that, you know, professional chefs know. If you go to a restaurant or a bakery, it's not like what you're ordering that night is the first time the chef made it. I mean, the chef and his cooks or her cooks have been testing and testing and testing until they just get it right. And so there's that element that is even amplified further with the world of bread, because it's a living thing. You're handling something that is fermenting, that is basically breathing, and it's producing CO2 and ethanol. And so there's a lot of things that you have to basically do to guide it to where you want it to be, right? It's not like you just mix it and walk away. You can, there's moments where you have to really tend to it and make sure that it's not going to get out of your hands. And so all of that sort of information exists in our book. Some people might find it a bit overwhelming to have to read all of the technique and theory before they actually get their hands into the dough, but it's very important to do that simply because it just does give you a much better understanding of what you're doing. And so what we're trying to do with giving people so much information is to do exactly what you said, which is, you know, try to take that fear away that people may have from the concept of making bread or whatever concept they might have about modernist cuisine being like a very elevated form of cooking. So, you know, we allocated a lot of resources and time to making sure that all the information was there. We didn't dumb it down. I mean, because our reader base deserves all of the information. What we did is we basically think of it as translating one language, like the language of science, into the language of lay people. You know, there's a lot of smart people that aren't scientists. And so understanding that is what made us come up with the language that we have in our book. We're heavy on photography for step-by-steps. We're heavy on, you know, I wouldn't say over-explaining, but explaining very clearly the steps and the techniques to help people make, you know, successful loaf of bread in their home or wherever they choose to make it. Now, one of the most important things I'm going to say is, you know, you may have heard this before, but, you know, one of the biggest paths to failure is to utilize volume measures instead of using weight. And so even though we did include volume measures in our recipes, because some people are just comfortable with that, I would say my biggest suggestion would be for people to actually just spend $20 and buy a scale, because the recipes, you know, we wrote them in metric, which is, I think, a lot better than the imperial system. But weighing things out is going to give you that accuracy that volume is never going to give you. If I think of very small ingredients that we use, like yeast, I mean, there's some ingredients that are so small that you couldn't even measure them with the smallest measuring spoon, like making a pre-ferment, a starter that utilizes like an eighth, a 16th of a teaspoon of yeast, that unit doesn't exist, you know. But a scale could surely measure 1 gram of yeast, you know. So these are the things that would make people feel like more secure and that they have more to work with if they've never made bread before and they're trying to attempt, you know, their first loaf of bread. So these are just tips and suggestions that we give for people just in general to make sure that they can do a good job or at least feel successful with the end result.
I love the idea that it's a book that grows with you, that you can sort of start with these beginner recipes if you've never made a loaf of bread before in your life and, you know, really excel to a place where you're baking at a level that many of us mm-hmm. don't think we ever could. What was your own journey like to getting to the place that you did in cuisine? And what mm-hmm. were a few of the turning points where something really, a switch really flipped for you about food or about sort of the uh-huh. hows and whys of what works in a kitchen?
So I started working in professional kitchens when I was in high school. So I think I was like 16 years old or so. And it was... It's a long-ish journey. I mean, I'm 43 right now, so it's almost 30 years that I've been working in kitchens. But every place that I've worked at has given me something important to learn. But I think one of the most interesting things is that where I learned the most about cooking was when I was teaching about cooking. I was a professor at the Culinary Institute of America in New York for close to 9 years. And what was very important about that experience was that even though I knew how to do something, that didn't matter. What I had to do was teach somebody who had never done X, Y, or Z recipe before how to do it and how they could be successful at doing it as well. And so the way the program works at the Culinary Institute of America is that every 3 weeks, the students move on to a different class. So what it means for the teachers is that every 3 weeks, they get a new group of students. So I had to make sure that in those 3 weeks, the students would get all of the everything that they could from me. What was great about that experience is because the recipes had to be written and explained in a way that is not best case scenario, because life is not best case scenario. And so what I've done since I worked at the CIA and moving forward is always write recipes with that in mind. If I look at a recipe and for the most part, what I'm looking at is everything is perfect, right? Everybody has a great oven. It's an even 70 degrees Fahrenheit in the kitchen. And everything is just working out just so, when in reality, life is a little bit messier than that. And there's a lot of human folly involved in when we're cooking. Because usually when we cook at home, we're doing it because we want to. It's a pleasurable thing. And it shouldn't be this like high stress sort of, oh my God, if I ruin this, you know, my life will be miserable. And you avoid that by giving people more information than they even thought they needed. Because sometimes you don't know how many ways there is to make a mistake or to ruin something. And so that was my biggest takeaway from teaching so many students for so many years, was providing people with things to think ahead of and things that they could prevent from happening before they even got started. So that was a big learning experience. But I think that the biggest turning point for me was embracing science as the answer to basically resolving any sort of food question I had, or to perfecting any method or technique that I wanted to get better at. Because you can read a recipe and you can practice it 10,000 times, but if it comes out wrong every time, you're going to start to wondering why it's not turning out the way you want it to turn out. In 2006, I no, 2009, I went on a trip to Spain with a group of chefs to an R&D facility in Barcelona, where basically it's an R&D facility for chefs. It's not for industrial production of food. It's for people who cook in restaurants, and so it's a much smaller scale sort of R&D place. And they were telling me about a recipe that they had developed for making pastry cream. And one of the things that I taught my students, like every 3 weeks, was how to make pastry cream. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, there's no way these guys have a better way of making pastry cream than me. There's just absolutely no way. And I was like sneering at it, and it was like, you know, just like, okay, show me your technique, you know? And after they showed it to me and how much better it was than mine, and how much faster and how much more efficient it was, that was the turning point for me, which was like, even when I thought I knew everything about something, there's always a better way to do it. And the better way to do it is always understanding how those ingredients work with each other, what their capacity is, what their limits are for, let's say, heat, what their limits are for temperature, and how to get the best out of it. And so after having, you know, seen and tasted this like absolutely wonderful pastry cream, I changed the way I made it for so many years. And that opened my eyes to everything else. It's like, well, if this happened with this one little thing, I can start questioning pretty much everything else that I've done in the past. And so it's not to say that I don't do anything the same that I did 20 years ago, but certain things, I've certainly found better ways of doing them. I have certainly found ways of perfecting them, and more importantly, ways of explaining it to people, how to make it better. And so that I think was the biggest eye opener turning point for me in my professional career.
I love that, the idea that even just not being so attached to your way of doing something is really the first step to learning how to do it another way. I want to talk a little bit about troubleshooting, because you said something that made me laugh, which is that you didn't realize how many different ways there were basically for people to mess up a recipe, which is so true. What are some of those main mistakes that people seem to make with bread over and over again, that if you could just kind of give people five things to stop doing, what are those?
Well, it's to stop or start too. I might give you more than five if that's okay, but
sure.
I think like the first one is to buy a scale. I mean, in the United States, for some reason, every home has every size of volume measure you can imagine, which occupies a good amount of cupboard space, versus a scale, which occupies probably 5 square inches of space, and is precise. And you don't need to wash all of these measuring cups when you're done. It all goes into the same mixer. But that would be the first one. So it's measuring ingredients imprecisely and then wondering, why did it go wrong? That is one of the first things. The other is, whenever people are, like on Facebook, people will message me because I have a professional page there, and they'll message me. It's like, I tried this recipe and it didn't work out. And so I start to ask them, well, tell me how you did it. And so they start to tell me, well, I substituted this ingredient for that ingredient, and I did this instead of that. Why did my recipe not turn out well? So, because you didn't follow the recipe.
Right.
So that is an enormous factor. That is like, if the recipe says to utilize light rye flour, use light rye flour. Don't use semolina. I mean, these are basic things that you just need to make sure before you get started, read the recipe from beginning to end, and then get started. The other would be, I would say, when people are mixing dough, is not knowing exactly how much they should develop the dough. You know, if you're mixing by hand, it's one thing. If you're mixing by machine, it's another. They're two different things. So what we're looking for when we're mixing dough is stages of gluten development. Gluten is the protein in your dough that is going to make bread what is bread, which is this chewy substance that is pleasurable to eat. It stretches. You know, it's the thing that gluten-free breads don't have. It's like eating a gluten-free bread is like eating a pound cake, a savory pound cake, right? Basically because it has like no gluten structure. So gluten is the part of the dough that we want to develop by mixing. And so there's different stages. There's three basic stages. There's low gluten development, medium gluten development, and full gluten development. Low gluten development is when we first start mixing and the gluten starts to develop lightly. If we pull on the dough, it tears easily. If we keep mixing, we develop it further and further. And so when we pull on it, it has a little bit more resistance, but eventually you can tear it apart. And we have full gluten development. You're able to do something that's called, the window pane test, which is to take a small piece of the dough with both hands, you stretch it, and it gets to the point where it's a very thin membrane that does not tear. At this point, you know your dough has already been mixed to full gluten development. That's what you want your dough to be at before you proof it. Anything less than that, what you're going to have is a dough that is probably not as chewy. It's probably not as elastic. It might lose, you know, some volume while it's baking because it's not strong enough to withstand, you know, that spring in the oven. So it's getting the dough to that right gluten development. The other would be determining when the dough is proofed, right? Because there isn't a piece of equipment that can tell you, okay, your dough is now proofed, meaning the yeast has already fermented this dough properly. It's got, you know, a beautiful amount of CO2 bubbles inside and it's ready to bake. The only thing that you can use to determine whether your dough is in proof or not is what we call, or what is called, the finger test, the fingertip test, which is literally that. You push the dough with your finger. If you push the dough with your finger and it springs back immediately, it means it's not proofed yet. If you push the dough and it springs back, but just it takes it a few seconds to spring back and then it doesn't spring back completely, that's when your dough is ready to bake. This takes practice. This is not something that, you can watch videos on it. You can see, you know, we took a ton of pictures of what, you know, for every one of our recipes, what the finger test would look like with all the doughs. But it's something that you have to experience so that you develop the muscle memory for it. And that is something that is going to take a little bit of practice. Let's say you've mixed your dough now, you measured everything properly, you mixed your dough to the proper gluten development, it's perfectly proofed. The next step is baking it. The challenge with baking in a home oven is that most home ovens, in fact, I think it's safe to say that every home oven is meant to cook a large variety of things. Meaning if I were to compare it to a baker's oven, a baker's oven is called a bread oven for a reason, because all it's supposed to bake is bread. So it's a very specialized oven in which it's very hard to obtain bad bread from it because the thing was designed to bake bread. But if you're baking in a home oven, you're going to have to work around it to try to make it act like a bread oven. And so that is one of the biggest challenges that home bakers are going to face. And also, let's face it, I mean, sometimes, you know, not everybody owns their home. Sometimes you rent an apartment, you rent a house, and you have to deal with the kitchen that comes with the house. And, you know, typically the landlord will not have invested in, like, the best oven for a home. It's going to be a pretty rinky-dink oven. So not ideal for baking bread. And there is a simple solution to it. I mean, the simple solution that we have for it is to utilize a cast iron pot that is called a cast iron combination cooker, which it's basically something you can find on Amazon. It's like $40, but it's two pieces of cast iron that kind of bond to each other. And so the wonderful thing is that if you preheat your oven with a cast iron combination cooker, it's going to get as hot as the oven, but it's going to retain the heat. If you think of whenever you open an oven door, you open the door, you're opening a sixth of the oven, and therefore all of the hot air is going to exit the oven. So every time you open the door and you close it, you've dropped temperature really dramatically. But if the cast iron pot is in there, the cast iron is going to retain that heat for a long period of time. It doesn't matter how many times you open and close the door, it's going to stay hot. So we take the combination cooker out, we put our proof dough in there, we score it, meaning we cut it with a very sharp blade. Then we put the lid back, the cast iron combination pot lid on top, and we put it back in the oven. Now, what is wonderful about this is there's many layers to why it's wonderful. A, cast iron combination cooker is made of this metal, iron, which, like I said already a couple times, is that it really absorbs heat very well. But The other great thing is that it also radiates heat very well. And so it's going to radiate it into your dough. And it's going to radiate it much better than a lot of these other, like, Dutch ovens. Dutch ovens, I don't recommend, simply because they're very thin. They don't radiate and absorb heat as well as cast iron does. They're good for making stews on the stove and so on and so forth, but not really for making bread. They're okay for making bread, but not great. And also, if you notice, most of those, Dutch ovens, they're beige on the inside or white on the inside. White and those light colors are the worst for radiating heat. Cast iron is black. So that blackness is going to really radiate heat into your dough. That is a physics thing. It's not something that we made up. It's not something that we discovered. It's the reason why the space shuttle is black at the bottom and not white. If it was white at the bottom, it would burn up in a minute. Black is really going to be able to deflect that heat. So the cast iron is really going to have that radiant heat that's going to bake your bread quickly. But also, notice that I didn't say anything about steaming. And the reason why I don't say anything about steaming is because the dough, if it's enclosed in this combination cooker, it produces its own steam. You've probably seen so many people that they have all of these different ways of adding steam to their dough, and they spray water in there, or there's a pan, and they throw ice in it, and it produces steam. And the problem with those techniques is that it's very inconsistent how much steam you exactly are going to be adding into your oven cavity. It's always going to be different because you're not injecting the same amount of water every time. With the cast iron combination cooker, the dough is producing its own steam. You don't have to worry about that. It's like, it's not... It'll be consistent every single time. As long as you close the lid tightly, it's going to be good to go. And in about 45 minutes to 50 minutes, you're going to have a beautiful loaf of sourdough bread. So that is a simple solution. If you buy a thermometer, if you buy a scale and the cast iron combination cooker, those three things, it's under $100, are going to ensure that you're going to make some really nice bread in your house. So you're basically bypassing so many things that are so out of your control that you can make them be in your control just by doing these simple things.
I think so often when people make bread at home and it doesn't go well, they feel so powerless. They feel like, I screwed up. It's not for me. I can't make bread at home and I'm not going to try again. And I think what this book does and what your amazing work and research does is really show that it's not hard. It's actually just science. If you just kind of invest in these few things and learn a few techniques that work every time, you're on your way to having really reliable fresh bread that you can have the confidence to make any time without it being a mystery whether it's going to turn out or not.
Right. Those are the tools we want to give people is that, you know, you're, and I hear you, what you're saying. It's like it's so frustrating mostly because, okay, so let's say you overcook a chicken breast. You'll kind of still eat it. You know, it'll be dry, but you'll eat it. And then you'll probably cook another chicken breast in a week or so. And the reason is because it's so quick to do, right? Where a loaf of bread, you're investing your time. And the true cost of bread is not in the ingredients. The ingredients for bread are cheap. The true cost is going to be in the time that you invest in it. And it's not just your time. If you buy any artisan loaf of bread in a bakery, yes, sure, you're paying for the ingredients, but what you're paying for most, more than anything, is the labor that goes into making that loaf of bread. Because of all of the time that is involved in making this apparently very simple food, and I say apparently because it's not, it's a very complex food, a lot of work and time goes into it. So those are the things that dishearten people, yes, when their loaf of bread didn't turn out well or it wasn't perfect. But, you know, again, this whole thing where if you've never made bread before and you're thinking it's going to be like successful the very first time you make bread, you need to manage your expectations because it's probably not going to be the case. And you just need to keep trying. I mean, but it's worth it. That's the biggest part. It's like, it's worth making and having that patience and that practice to make wonderful bread because, you know, imagine being the person who brings that to a dinner party or the person that has that in their home. You know, that's a wonderful thing to do. Because, I mean, bread is not that expensive, so we just buy it instead of making it. It's very convenient, but making your own bread is a very special thing. We think so, anyway.
And I think it also reminds you of sort of the basic alchemy of cooking, that you are taking these really cheap, really, you know, seemingly very simple ingredients, flour, water, salt, yeast, and it's actually one of the most complicated and varied and interesting and sort of elevated things you can make. So I think for any home cook, even if you're not going to be a bread baker every day for the rest of your life, it is really good to sort of get in that mindset
Sure.
And learn some of those lessons. So thank you so much for coming to talk with us today. It's really fascinating.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I hope everyone will check out the book, Modernist Bread, The Art and Science.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And tune in next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.